Hey everyone, Chat Cemetery is back. I'm your host, Deanna Chapman, and today I am joined by a brand new guest, Nat Bremmer. Nat, how are you doing today?
I am doing great. I really can't wait to dig into this.
Yes, we are talking all about Riding the Bullet, which is a movie adaptation of one of Stephen King's novellas. But before we dive in, since you're a brand new guest, can you tell the listeners a little about yourself?
I am a writer for Wicked Horror, Bloody Disgusting. I've written for Dread Central, Diabolique Magazine. I have a short story collection I just put out called Slices of Julie, and I am a lifelong King fan.
Perfect. What I'm learning lately is that all of my guests seem more qualified for this podcast than I am.
No, I've listened before. You've done great.
Well, thank you. And why don't we go ahead and dive into Riding the Bullet? This is a 2004 adaptation, and this was one I had not seen before. I bought it a while back. It was like one of the two DVD sets or something. It was this and Big Driver is in it, which is coming up pretty soon for me, I think. But I read the novella not too long ago because it was in one of his collections that I did recently. And I thought the story was very intense and high paced, so I was looking forward to this, and knowing that it's Mick Garris too, he's pretty loyal to the source material for the most part, I would say. And it's not necessarily that I think he's had some of the best adaptations, but I've liked pretty much all of his stuff enough.
That is definitely accurate. I think that's a lot of stuff that you get with Mick Garris in King adaptations, is it's oftentimes so loyal that it's just like, okay, yeah, that's the story. Like, this is what happens at this moment, and this is what happens here. That checks out. And like, I really like Mick Garris as a director, but sometimes there's a bit of an emotional distance to it with me. And this is why I was really excited to do this, is I actually think this might be Mick Garris's best movie.
Okay.
Just as a film, because I think that there, especially with it being obviously a lot smaller than The Stand and the miniseries, is there's an emotional core to this, and kind of the smallness of this that I think really shines through.
Absolutely. And for anyone who doesn't know, I just want to quickly run down some of the other titles that Mick Garris has done. He did Sleepwalkers in 92. Again, this was in 2004. He did The Stand miniseries. He's done so many things. Quicksilver Highway and The Shining were both in 97. Only half of Quicksilver Highway was King-related. The other half, I believe, was a Clive Barker story.
Yep.
He did Desperation in 2006 after this, Bag of Bones in 2011. So obviously some stuff that I haven't even watched just yet. But he is someone who very clearly loves King's work. And you can tell just how much he loves the horror genre in general. I don't know if you've had a chance to listen to his podcast, Postmortem.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Yeah. And he's talked about all of these things in his own podcast. So I highly recommend checking that out if anyone listening has been interested in Mick Garris's Stephen King work in particular, or just in general. But with Riding the Bullet, you have a very interesting cast too, because I thought this was a very, very fun David Arquette performance.
Extremely.
Yeah, and then you have Jonathan Jackson, who went on to be one of the stars in Nashville. It's a show I watched for a little bit, but then it got to be too dramatic for my liking. So I was like, all right, I am not following through with this one. But basically, those two men, Cliff Robertson, you have Barbara Hershey, Cynthia Garris, of course, makes an appearance, as does Mick Garris, because that is a running theme with a lot of his adaptations, and Matt Frewer as well, which is always a pleasant surprise.
That's one of my favorite things about Mick Garris's filmography, is it usually guarantees a place for Matt Frewer, who is an actor that I adore. Like, I would legitimately watch him in anything.
That seems to be the general consensus with people who like the Garrus King adaptations too. It's one of those things where it's fun to pick out these recurring characters. And I've been doing that outside of the Garrus adaptations in particular, because so many people happen to return to Stephen King adaptations for one reason or another. You have Gary Sinise in The Stand, and he had a bit in The Green Mile. And it's just amazing how many people return to King adaptations, whether it's because they are also fans of his work or just by happenstance.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Like, it's amazing. You would not ever think about, you know, the amount of Stephen King adaptations that John Cusack has been in.
Yeah. Because if I'm not mistaken, him and Sam Jackson are both in 1408 and Cell.
Yep.
Truly amazing. And I love catching those little things, because it's something to look forward to when I do these episodes too. And I think Jonathan Jackson puts on a very good performance as well, because there are scenes where he's literally talking to himself.
Yes.
And that's hard to do.
Yeah, I really, and we'll definitely get into kind of the way this is structured, which is kind of unique, but I really like how much of the movie plays out in his head.
Mm-hmm.
I really kind of related to this character in a lot of specific ways and to that performance. And I think that's one of the things that stood out the most to me, is that maybe I don't necessarily see myself interacting with a version of myself, but I have that, you know, a lot of people who have that, you know, version of you in the back of your mind, kind of the backseat driver who's calling you an asshole in the middle of conversations. That really resonated with me.
You can tell that there's a mental health aspect to this too, because it's not necessarily that Alan has any mental health problems right away, but at the beginning we see he's suicidal, and mm-hmm. we don't know if he's actually been officially diagnosed with anything, mm-hmm. but that back and forth between himself and, you know, sort of the devil and angel on his shoulder that is himself as well, it really displays that in a unique way, because we've seen certain King adaptations such as Secret Window where there's a split personality, but the character is not seeing himself. He's seeing a different person entirely. And to have it just be the same actor in this, I think takes it to a slightly different level.
Yeah. Yeah. It feels a little more natural, because it's more, you know, the way one can tend to interact with themselves, especially once he gets in Staub's car and everything, and mm-hmm. it becomes more of that kind of immediate, like, inner monologue of that just repeating, like, don't let him know you know, kind of thing. Like, yeah. That. Yeah, that for sure.
And trying to keep the lie straight while he's talking to George, you're just like, okay, this is something where I can see how he would slip up easily, because there's so much going on in his head. He's trying to get to his mom. He's having to hitchhike because his friends went to Toronto without him, so he's carless. And he was in someone else's car before, but it was kind of like this creepy old guy, and you think things are going to get really weird there. And it was just very impressive how that came across on the screen, the sort of battle he was having with himself.
Yeah. And there's something just so unique about framing a story with a character who, whether accidentally or not, attempts suicide at the beginning,
mm-hmm.
and yet at that point still has not necessarily accepted the reality of death. And I think so much of the story is about getting him to that point. And, you know, a lot of stories are about accepting mortality, but not as many focus on the specific transition of when it becomes, in, you know, this case of a very literal kind of making death a tangible thing. But, like, I think the Cliff Robertson bit is really effective, because that's also a moment where he's starting to realize he's getting closer to being in the presence of death, where it's like, this old man feels like he's about to die, and I do not want to watch him die. You know, I do not want to be in this car when he dies. I need to get out of here.
And he also sees the man talking to his presumably dead wife.
Yes. Yes. And I also, with that in mind, one of my favorite bits in the movie is just those little moments, even starting at the beginning with the, you know, how often George Staub's car comes into play before he actually gets inside of it.
And we even see George himself, but Alan doesn't really seem to register that at the time, or the fact that it's the same car that ran him off the road when he was in the van with the pretend hippie kind of guy. And
nearly took him out, like, in the street, like, before he even left the university.
Yeah. I also want to give a quick shout out to Erica Christensen, who plays his girlfriend, Jessica, because that kind of sets up some of the tension at the beginning of the movie. She kind of breaks up with him, but kind of doesn't, and then tries to surprise him right as he is slitting his wrist and startles him in the bathtub with a whole bunch of people there. And everything she did was just such poor timing.
Yes. Oh my God. I have never seen like so much on again, off again in a relationship that is on screen for so little like amount of time.
Yeah, because she doesn't come back until pretty much the very end, right?
Yeah, because like she kind of jokes about breaking up with him and then is like, no, you know, we're totally together. Then she actually breaks up with him. And then by the end, they get married and it's like, oh, but it didn't last.
Yeah, it is very wild how up and down that relationship is, like you said, in so little time, too. And then you get this great performance from Barbara Hershey, too, as Alan's mom, Jean. And she has so much going on at any given time when she's on screen. She's either in the hospital or she is dealing with his father's death in some way. And it's such a packed performance from her with so little screen time as well.
Yeah, we get so much out of it. It's like the opposite kind of end where we get so much out of her performance with so little time. It's like we get just enough to kind of feel, you know, everything that's going on with her.
Yeah, and I think we can get into David Arquette's performance more as we talk about the story, because we spend a good chunk of time with him and Alan in the car, which is very Christine-esque. You can tell that Stephen King has a type of car that he enjoys. And if I'm not mistaken, though, Mick Garris took this story and placed it in the 60s instead of the early 2000s.
Yeah, yeah.
And that gives you that nod to Christine in a bit of a better way.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. Because you know, it's much more, the car is much more of the time than Christine. And I think that's also Garris kind of changing when it's set. I think that also, I don't know, I don't, you know, want to presume it, but it feels like it just makes it a little more personal of a story.
Right.
Like kind of changing it to when he was younger and when he was closer to that age, it feels a little more hard on the sleeve, and it feels, you know, it definitely kind of resonates that much more. The same with, Rob Reiner and King with Stand By Me. I think there's a lot, and even, the 2017 It, to just, you know, for filmmakers to change it to when they were the age that King was the age he was writing those characters. I think it helps kind of make those stories feel a little more resonant.
Mm-hmm. And what works well with doing that is that you can really feel the connection between the filmmaker and the film a lot better. And
yeah.
What Mick Garris does well, you know, and sometimes maybe it's to a fault, is staying true to the story, but knowing when to change something that isn't super major to how the story is told. It's just one of those things where, you know what, a college kid hitchhiking makes more sense in the late 60s than it does in 2001.
For sure. That was absolutely something I wrote down too. It's almost takes you out of it. Because I know even when I was reading this story at the time, I don't think too long. Well, I guess I read it for the first time in college too. I was thinking like, there's no way. And like, I get that it's that him hitchhiking is meant to convey that sense of desperation. But at the same time, like, there's mm-hmm. no way anyone would do that.
And, you know, maybe Maine is a different place. And that is a place where people will still do those things if they really need to. But for me personally, I was like, huh, the fact that this was 2001 and someone was hitchhiking seems a little strange. Not to say that no one hitchhikes now, but it definitely seems way, way less common.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's actually part of why I grew up so much with Stephen King, why Stephen King and his work was kind of always a part of my life. Like, I can't ever really remember not knowing about it, is because I grew up in Maine.
Okay.
I was born and raised in the town where Storm of the Century was actually shot. So I grew up with all of that. So like, I know when he's conveyed, like when Maine is being conveyed, honestly. And there's a lot with adaptations in particular. I kind of can't help but kind of judge on a sort of Maine scale. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, do I believe this is Maine?
Right.
And some of the best adaptations are like Salem's Lot is an adaptation that I love that doesn't feel like anything but Southern California.
Okay.
But this one in particular, I really, you know, like there's a lot of the depiction of the time and the people that, and especially like Cliff Robertson, which are sort of that kind of Stephen King main archetype.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I like that this story tends to stray from sort of the way King typically like depicts Mainers in the past. Like, there's not a lot of that, you know, that kind of that Judge Crandall main archetype that sort of weaves its way into King works. And that's one of the things I actually enjoy about this is that it's just, you know, believably, like, it is, you know, technically set in Maine, but it could be just about anywhere.
Yeah, because a lot of this takes place at night and on two-lane roads, which I live in Colorado now. That's not something you typically find in Southern California as much, which is where I'm from, but here it's something that, you know, you can go a mile from where I live now and you'll be on a two-lane road.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very easy to picture these things as happening almost anywhere. And that is kind of what makes King stories terrifying too. It's not necessarily like, oh, these bad things only happen in Maine. It's like, no, even though it's Maine, you can still relate to it in other parts of the country or even the world.
Absolutely. Though I will admit that some stuff really, growing up there, really really kind of made it a little extra terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when I read it for the first time, I know every inch of Bangor, so I knew every location
right
by heart. So everything, every terrible thing that Pennywise did that got stuck in my brain, I knew physically, like, exactly where it was. So it didn't feel like remotely escapable.
Right. That's totally understandable. And since you have that experience of growing up in Maine for at least some period of time, do you think that when Maine doesn't come across as well as it could in some of the adaptations, it's simply because, one, they're not being filmed in Maine for the most part, and two, maybe the filmmakers haven't actually been to Maine?
Yeah, I think that is a huge part of it. And like, some of the, I don't want to say worst, but some of the least, you know, highly regarded adaptations were shot completely in Maine. So it doesn't always necessarily mean like that anything like great for the story necessarily. Like, I think the Langoliers really suffers from being completely shot in the Bangor airport, because even though that's where it's set, it's not a remotely attractive location to set an entire miniseries.
Also just a weird story, in my opinion.
Yes, because on the subject, it's kind of the one area where it doesn't mean anything. I don't think it affects like the film at all, but just kind of like my personal mainometer I have with adaptations, the one part of Riding the Bullet that extremely doesn't pass for me is that I just, because I grew up in the area, I know kind of the University of Maine campus by heart. So in the film, I'm like, oh, they didn't even try to dress this up.
Yeah, it's one of those things where I don't necessarily think it's crucial to film in the location where a story is set, because we know, there are so many shows that quote unquote take place in New York City or something, and they're actually filmed in Toronto, or they're filmed in Vancouver. Yep. And, you know, there are so many places that look like other places. You know, the Salem's Lot remake was filmed in Australia.
Yep.
And it's like, oh, okay, I would not have guessed that based on, you know, the town we saw. And with this, because a lot of it is on the back roads, again, you don't necessarily need that exact main location, but
completely
with the story, you know, to dive into that a little bit, basically Alan gets this call that his mother is in the hospital, and this is after everything has happened. He's been in the hospital, he's out of the hospital now, he has tickets to go to see John Lennon, and then he gets this call and he just gives the tickets to his two friends, and they go off and, you know, drive off in the car, and then he's trying to get a bus, misses the bus, has to hitchhike, and basically from the start, everything is going wrong for Alan. Mm-hmm. And then he just gets taken on this wild ride, and even though he knows that there's something wrong with both of the people he spent a good chunk of time with while hitchhiking, he ends up with the worst of the two by far.
Yes. That's such a King thing, is presenting a situation where your mind is running with worst case scenarios, like from the beginning, and then finding the even worse one to present you. Because what actually happens, like the choice Alan is presented with, is legitimately horrifying. And I really kind of, I think one of the reasons I like Riding the Bullet so much is because I really respond to that kind of story in general, because there is nothing more terrifying to me than picking, like, you know, dangling the choice of having to choose for someone you love to die. And the way it's presented and the way it's kind of dangled and the way it unfolds and the choice he actually winds up making is it's ghoulish. It's nightmarish. It's the worst possible outcome, instead of just making the choice to have to live with the knowledge, to continue the relationship with a person with the knowledge that you made the choice.
Right. I think the whole thing just plays out really well too, especially from Alan's perspective, because he is having one bad thing after another happen to him. Some are within his control, some are not. Mm-hmm. And you see in the end how he still tries to have some hope.
Yes. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that definitely is also, I think, a huge stylistic thing of King's, is there are very few kind of hopeless King stories, even if it's like, everybody died and, you know, sometimes things happen. Or if it's just, you know, even the end of The Body, just being like, well, yeah, those are my friends and they're all dead now. But I think that definitely is key. And I think that really, really works here.
Yeah, what did you think of the roller coaster scenes in particular? How effective were those for you?
I get it. I'm not sure, like, because it does come up a lot There are a couple things I don't love about the way that it, about the ending of the film necessarily, but I love the idea of it. I love the kind of the representation of the roller coaster, and I love the notion of signifying death as kind of the thing you were most afraid of as a child, like the first time you were a kid and were really afraid you were going to die. So I really love what the bullet represents in that regard. But actually seeing him kind of riding the bullet as an older man kind of took me out of it a little bit.
Yeah. It was one of those things where I think it worked the first time or two. But yes, once you see the roller coaster too many times, you're kind of like, okay. I think what was effective too was the scene when he was a younger boy and was with his mom and chickened out at the last minute after she had stood there waiting in line with him for quite some time, it seems. And that felt like a kid thing to do. You know, that felt very realistic. And her reaction was just like, are you kidding me? And maybe she shouldn't have slapped him, which, you know, she later apologizes for. But it was one of those moments where you're just like, okay, this is sort of the amusement park scene that works well, and maybe then just do the roller coaster once. And that would have been, I think, more powerful as a concept too. Maybe you have that scene where, you know, he is on it and all the dead people are with him, and that's it.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely agree with that. And I think, as much as I love the, like, the little kind of movie-in-a-movie genre pastiches, I think those also worked really well. But, you know, by the fourth or fifth one, we're like, we get it. You know, I understand. So it's kind of in the same regard as that, for sure.
Yeah, I also just really love how much fun David Arquette is obviously having with the character of George, because he comes across in the novella a little more intense and less wacky, but I think the way Arquette portrays him in this works a little better for an on-screen performance.
Yeah, and I also do think some of those things, you know, are present in the novella. One of the things I love about Arquette's performance in this is that he's totally hamming it up, for sure, but he's not hamming it up in a way that is, you know, untrue to the way King writes, because a lot of times King will write these undead characters on the page who are very tongue-in-cheek and don't necessarily get that when they're put on screen. Like, I think, like, for example, like the greasers and Sometimes They Come Back, in the movie could have standed to be a little, you know, a little more like this, because like he has like an energy, and as you can tell that Arquette is just having so much fun with the role, and I think that is definitely a big part of it. But I think that also extends to what I love about it in general. It's one of those movies where you can absolutely tell that Mick Garris had a blast just making it.
Right. For me, when I was watching David Arquette in the car in particular, it felt like he was definitely hamming it up, like you said. But I guess for whatever reason, to me in the novella, he came across as a little more terrifying than he did in this. It's like, yes, he's terrifying in the sense that he's unpredictable in the movie, but you can kind of tell he's just going off and, you know, he's going wild with everything. It's one of those things where he's threatening, but he's not overbearingly intimidating, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. That does make a lot of sense. And I also, I think so much of what I like about the performance is like, there is a bit of a, you know, slow kind of unveiling of him and his intentions when they're in the car. But for the most part, his performance as his character, like, he really kind of wears it on his sleeve. Like, there's something wrong about him from the get-go. And, like, he doesn't come out and state who he is, but he also doesn't make any attempts to, like, hide who he is. And I think I think that's a really fun kind of performance.
I also love the scene where his hat comes off.
Yes.
It was so good. And it's not even that it was super gory or anything. It was like the perfect amount to give you more context as to who this character is and what's going on with them.
Yeah, for sure. And I love, like I said, you know, sometimes the little kind of movie pastiches kind of got, you know, over it after a while. But like, I love the little movie in a movie vignette about his death.
Yeah.
That I think is a lot of fun. That kind of Steve McQueen styled little car accident mini movie in the middle of the narrative was a lot of fun. It was really where you could tell kind of the glee they must have had in making this.
This certainly falls under the ridiculous but fun category for me with the King adaptations, because there are some that are just flat out bad. And there are some that you know aren't the best movies ever, but you have fun watching them. And it's like this. Maximum Overdrive is like that for me. And there are certainly some others. But before we dive into ratings here, is there anything else you want to touch on with the movie?
There are a lot of times where I thought that this was really kind of cleverly paced.
Yeah.
Like before we even, like, one, like I mentioned, there's the repeated appearances of like the car. But even before we get into necessarily like the plot and the hook and everything, I just love that little bit, like really early on, where Erica Christensen, she's like, you know, who loves you in the hospital? He's like, my mom.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, that really pays off later.
Yeah, that's one of those fun little scenes that comes back around and you're just like, oh, yes, I see what you did there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But in general, I really like that as campy and as tongue-in-cheek as this adaptation gets, I really kind of dig what it's about and the kind of the way it deals with death, kind of the way that like being someone who is an artist and is obsessed with death in art is not the same as necessarily understanding the actual tangibility of death. And I really like the way it explores. And I also think that I relate to the character in a lot of ways. And that really made the movie resonate for me, especially because, you know, in general, I was that kid who would always get to the front of the line and chicken out. And my parents hated it. Like, usually I would wind up going on the ride, but sometimes, you know, like Alan, I legitimately didn't. And so that, you know, that whole hook of the story kind of struck a personal chord in a way that I appreciate.
Yeah, and full disclosure, I actually just went and looked at my Letterboxd rating, and after talking about this, I was like, you know what? I'll bump it up a half star because I think this was more fun than I initially gave it credit for. So that brings my rating to a 2.5 out of 5 on Letterboxd, but it seems like you enjoyed this a little more than I did, but you're probably at least somewhat close with the rating, given that, you know, I think anyone who's watched a lot of adaptations knows that there's like a certain tier of adaptation. Yeah. And it's just like, all right, these are kind of the untouchables. And then everything else comes after it.
Yeah, this is no Shawshank, Stand By Me, or Dolores Claiborne, or Misery. This is as much as I love it, it's still around probably like 3-star movie for me. Although King did say that this was his favorite independent adaptation after Stand By Me.
Yeah, I totally get why he would say that too, because aside from the time period change, it is a pretty faithful adaptation. And Mick Garris, as we've both said, is kind of known for not screwing with King's work too much. It's not like he pulled a Kubrick on him or anything.
Yeah, like I said, this is pretty much just, you know, this is a fun one.
Yeah, it certainly was. I liked it more than I expected to, because this was one I actually hadn't heard a lot about going into this. It seems like, I don't want to say it's a forgotten adaptation. I think maybe just a lot of people don't know about it because, like you said, it was an independent release. It wasn't a TV miniseries that they made a big deal out of at the time or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. This was, I would say this is, you know, I've tended to call this underappreciated, but I do agree that, that it's more that it's underseen.
Yeah. Well, Nat, thank you so much for coming on to talk about Riding the Bullet. Where can people find you online?
At Nat Bremmer on Twitter is the big place. And look for my bylines, you know, like I said, Bloody Disgusting, Wicked Horror, Dread Central, stuff like that. Thanks for having me.
All right, that does it for this episode of Chat Cemetery. You can support the podcast on Patreon for $1 a month. You'll get a thank you on the show. For $2 a month, I will send you a Chat Cemetery sticker. And if you want to follow us on social media, you can do so at Chat Cemetery on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You could also rate and review the show. That's a huge help. And as always, thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.